Speak.
Hello.
Fine, right, that'll do. All right.
The CMU podcast in association with Seven Digital.
This week, Fabric, Amazon Tickets and OK Go. It's the CMU podcast, all music business, all the time. I'm Andy Malt, and always, every week, Chris Cook is with me. And I don't know, I'm getting tired of it.
You're getting tired of the format?
Yeah.
You think it's time for a presenter shake-up? Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to the news on that, on what the all-new format is going to look like. The tweet went out today from, I think it was actually the BBC reporting on ITV, which is a bit confusing. But it was ITV to shake up Saturdays, because they're going to shake up their Saturday night. I don't know what that means. I didn't click on the link. It had a picture of Vernon Kay, so I don't know if that means he's being axed.
It's either Vernon Kay is coming in, Vernon Kay is going out, or Anton Deck coming in, or Anton Deck going out. It's one of those two things.
I think Vernon Kay is possibly already there. And so perhaps it's that he's getting the boot.
Anton Deck are coming in.
And there's a bit more Anton Deck on a Saturday. Anyway, when I saw the headline, ITV to shake up Saturdays, all I could get... was the group Saturdays being shook up by ITV in a big plastic
It would be an
box.
Interesting TV format.
For an hour.
If they're not doing that, we should pitch it.
The Saturdays shaking around. But anyway, so clearly ITV are having a revamp of their Saturday nights. And sort of the CMU podcast, it's kind of a Saturday night podcast, isn't it? I imagine most of our listeners... That's when they listen.
They get a curry, have a few beers and listen to this.
And listen to the podcast. It's a Saturday night kind of thing. So I look forward to the revamp.
We've now established that come the new year, I think either Vernon Kay or Anton Deck are going to be my co-host.
Well, I think it's that Vernon Kay is possibly being axed, then he'll be available, possibly. So it'll be...
And he'll be cheaper than Anton Deck because there's only one of him.
Yes. And cheaper than me, of course. So everybody is a winner.
You really are a drain on this operation.
But so that's all something to look forward to in the new year.
Yes.
But what are we looking forward to this week?
Well, this week, I thought we'd talk about Amazon's plan to shake up the ticketing
More
industry.
More shaking things up.
Lots of shaking. And the amazing technical feat of OK Go's a new music video.
Yes, Andy Malt.
The irony that we're going to talk about a music video in this audio format.
Andy Malt, in a bid to add a bit of variety to the podcast this week, decided we were going to discuss a music video that we're not able to show you. But he's going to describe it.
It was that or a video of Justin Bieber punching someone, and that is also a video.
It is true. So we opted to talk about a video OK Go intended to create rather than a video that Bieber did not intend to be participating in. But you can read more about that in the CMU Daily. Are you making that beef of the week?
Yeah, I think so.
So you'll be able to read more about that in the CMU Daily that has just gone out as this podcast goes live, assuming this podcast goes live on time.
Well,
which
we'll
it might
see.
Do. Could do. Stranger things have happened. So that's to come.
Yeah. But first. Fabric is saved!
Fabric is saved.
Rendering all those T-shirts redundant.
Well done, everybody. Well done to all the people.
Well done to about a third of the people who donated money to the campaign.
Oh yeah, they didn't need all the money, did
they?
No,
they raised £300,000. They only spent £100,000.
So
most of that was on printing T-shirts.
So if you were amongst the people to donate the first, how much did they spend? 80 grand or something?
Yeah.
If you were amongst
I think it was a bit more than that, but the large chunk of that was T-shirt printing and sending out.
If you donated the first 100 grand, well done. You saved Fabric for everybody else. Well, you are too late to be part of the saving of Fabric. So are we going to do a very, very quick recap of this story?
We have talked about it. I think it's worth doing a very quick recap.
Oh, do a very quick recap.
So Fabric was closed in August, pending a license review, following two drug-related deaths at the venue. And then a month later, there was a licensing hearing, and Islington Council decided that they were going to revoke the club's license because of its culture of drugs.
And so at that point, Fabric, which had already been closed by that point for a month, in essence, that was it. No license, no operations, Fabric is shut, and the risk was that was it, no more Fabric, it would be gone for good.
Yes, but Fabric launched an appeal. However, unfortunately, having been closed for a month already, they didn't have any money, so it got the public to donate, which they did in large numbers, donated over £300,000.
Nearly 320 grand, I think.
Yeah, and they were all set to have a licensing appeal hearing the end of this month on the 28th of November. That was all chugging along. Fabric were giving regular updates on what stage they were at with it, what their lawyers were doing, what they were spending the money on, what money they had left. And then last week, sort of around the time we were recording the podcast,
yeah, towards the end of the week,
which is traditional, it was reported in Islington's local newspaper that Fabric and Islington Council were in advanced talks to get the club's licence back without going to court. And then on Monday, they confirmed that that had happened, which means Fabric is saved, no one has to go to court, and everything's fine now.
All is good. So, of course, this wasn't the first time Fabric had had a run-in with the council, despite the fact that traditionally, actually, compared to a lot of club operations both in London and elsewhere in the UK, Fabric had traditionally always enjoyed a good relationship with both the local council and the Metropolitan Police. But then they had a few issues about a year ago, wasn't it? And at that point, it looked like they might have the licence revoked. However, that did go to court, and that was the scenario where Fabric went into court and explained how they dealt with drug issues both in and around the club, and the sort of the health and safety staff and the medical staff that they have on site and all of that. And the judge hearing that particular appeal went above and beyond, saying how great Fabric were and that they were, you know, a real best practice club. And we know that actually some police officers had recommended other club promoters in London to go to Fabric to see how they ran things. So that was all happening until those horrible, tragic incidents occurred earlier this year. And then a whole new licensing challenge came about. And I suppose at the time of the hearing in September, the result of which was the license being taken away, Fabric went into that council hearing, which was obviously public domain, lots of people were there, and really argued their corner. And I think a lot of people in the room, now obviously the people that we know and the people that we were following who were sort of tweeting from the event, I suppose are on the clubbing music industry side, so perhaps they're a little bit biased. But you really got the impression that most of the people in the room felt that Fabric's management and the people speaking up for Fabric had presented a much stronger case than those people who were calling for the licence to be revoked. And yet the decision went that nope, culture of drugs, we're going to take your licence away.
And there were accusations, not least from, I think, Fabric itself, that this was sort of a retaliation for what happened with the previous court hearing where Fabric won and was held up as being a beacon of best practice, as the judge you mentioned called it. And it was sort of said that, you know, police hadn't really acted reasonably in this case and it was unfair to shut it down. There were lots of accusations thrown at the council, all of which are part of this new deal, have been retracted.
It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, so Fabric put out a statement on Monday. Well, actually, it was a joint statement, wasn't it?
It was a joint statement, but it was very much weighted towards Fabric saying sorry for a lot of things.
So, obviously, behind the scenes, as this appeal process was coming up, a lot of talks, a lot of politics, a lot of wrangling behind the scenes. Because I suppose, on one level, neither side really wanted this to go to court, because although Fabric had raised all that money, they would rather not spend it on lawyer fees to go into court. The council doesn't want to spend, to be fair, it doesn't want to spend its council taxpayers' money going to court on this. Perhaps also, we don't know this, but I remember you said this at the time, you sort of felt that the council were surprised at just how much support there was for Fabric.
Yeah.
And around the world, there were dance music fans and clubber fans who were saying that this is an outrage, this is a club that has gone above and beyond. And, you know, perhaps the councillors who were making the decision were unrealistic. The idea that if we shut this one club down, all the drug problems will go away.
Yeah.
Because clearly one club is behind all the drug issues in the borough. Actually, probably there was the risk of making drug problems worse. So perhaps the council were surprised at quite the fallout. And maybe that was another motivation for them. Oh, we don't want to have this going into court and then all the reporting around that. So whether or not it was a financial thing or whether it was a PR thing or whether it was just were, you know, within the council, pragmatic people who were actually shutting them down, although we stand by our points that there were certain things that this club should be doing differently in order to be allowed to operate. Actually, it's in nobody's interest for the club to be shut down, and therefore we should all do what we can to see if we can get the club back open sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and in terms of, I mean, you say, like, you know, the idea that shutting down a club would stop the drug problems, one of the things a lot of people said was actually, if you were going to take drugs, Fabric was one of the safest places to go and do it because of the support on offer if you get in a bad way. And we did have the other thing we had last week was the inquest into one of the deaths that caused this licence review. This 18-year-old man, Ryan Brown, and basically the inquest found that he'd managed to sneak some drugs, some ecstasy, into the club in his shoes. Him and his friends had all done that, and then they'd taken it once inside. One of his friends said he'd almost immediately been sick and found it was all a bit strong, and then he was kind of saying, oh God, are you feeling this? And this guy, Ryan Brown, wasn't feeling it, so he got annoyed and he went and bought some more off someone in the club, and he took it and then got in an extremely bad way. He was treated by medical staff in the club, ended up having a heart attack and then dying the next morning. But it was sort of fact that he had like seven times the normal recreational dose of MDMA in his system.
And in some ways, I mean, those horrible, horrible incidents sort of come on the back. I mean, there's a bigger picture story there, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, how would you come to have drugs that strong floating around?
And it sort of links into this sort of wider story that the drugs that are out there have increased in strength in recent years. And it's interesting, one person was telling me the other day that sort of came on the back of those so-called legal highs that became very fashionable 2 or 3 years ago, and people were buying them online. And then, of course, there was a whole debate about whether or not legal highs should in fact be legal, etc., etc. But there was an element of saying that that sort of perversely created extra competition within the market, and so then the drug dealers selling the illegal drugs then heightened the dosage so that they would stand out and give you a higher experience or whatever than the legal highs. But in doing so, that's very dangerous, because people are taking the amount of drugs that a few years ago possibly was fine for recreational use, but as that inquest found, now is a phenomenally dangerous, I mean, they were saying this was a phenomenally dangerous amount even for someone who was a regular user,
yeah,
let alone
yeah.
someone who was a very casual first-time
yeah,
user.
Yeah, this guy and his friends, I think they'd taken it before, but this guy and his friends were described as naive users, certainly. And so while, obviously, the fact that they managed to get drugs inside and buy drugs inside did sort of highlight an issue, perhaps, with the searches on the door. Although, I mean, to an extent, like, what you can't strip search everyone at the door.
Well, I mean, what one promoter said when all of this was going through the motions, at the end of the day, I mean, it's no secret that there is a problem with Class A drugs in our prison system.
Yeah.
So if people can smuggle Class A drugs into the prisons, where one assumes there is the absolute top-level security as people go into the building, then how are you going to stop against clubs? And even if you did manage to stop all dealers from getting into the venue and anybody from smuggling any drugs in, you can't stop people who've taken the drugs 5 minutes before they walk into the venue. If it's already in the system, it's already in the system. So even if you did manage to stop with searches on the door, a real crackdown on ensuring there were no dealers in the venue, you still need to have the education and the health and safety and the medical support, because inevitably people are going to take these substances before they go into the venue, and the venues need to be primed to ensure that everybody there has a safe night out.
And that was the other thing that was highlighted, I guess, in this inquest, is that the medical staff on site and the security did their job well. And that, you know, his friend said, like, obviously he seemed to be not having a good time, but they were all a bit kind of feeling weird on this ecstasy they'd taken. But he was spotted by a bouncer who was like, this guy's not having a good time, let's get him to the medical staff. Medical staff treated him as best they could, but it was sort of, he had a like temperature of, I think, nearly 42 degrees, which is not a good temperature to be. And unfortunately, he ended up dying. So that's, I mean, that's basically what led, one of the instances that led to this whole incident of Fabric being shut down and now reopened. And so in its statement, or the joint statement, Fabric says it accepts that its procedures in relation to searching were insufficient, as were procedures to prevent the consumption and dealing of drugs within the club itself. It accepts that the police acted reasonably and that the authority subcommittee was fully entitled to revoke its licence.
Yeah,
all of which are things Fabric was definitely not saying previously.
Particularly the last bit in terms of the tactics employed by the police and the council. But I suppose as part of these,
that's what it takes to get the doors open again, I guess
that's what it takes. And the behind-the-scenes wranglings that went on in the run-up to this, of course, despite Fabric saying at the initial hearing that it went above and beyond and had so many more practices than other clubs, and, I mean, lots of people within the industry were backing that up, so that's I'm not suggesting for a moment that that wasn't true. Having said that, the club has now committed to go even further in all of this, and it may well be that one of the things that swung it is that in preparation for the appeal hearing, Fabric had worked with various experts and external bodies to put together a new manual that not only listed all the things Fabric already did, both in terms of security and health and safety, but to then add a whole load of extra new measures that they said that they would introduce if they got their license back. And that run-in they had with the council a year ago, there was a couple of things that the council wanted to add to the licence at that point that subsequently got removed because they won in court.
Yes.
One of which I think was ID scanning, and one of which was sniffer dogs.
Yes.
Now, what Fabric's experts have said throughout is actually sniffer dogs are really rubbish at sniffing out drugs on a street on a Saturday night in a noisy part of town. But the ID scanning is one of the things that they didn't want to do last time, and they have now conceded that they will
do.
And
I think a new security company,
yes.
Which is also another thing that they've committed to get in order to get their licence back.
So there is a number of new measures that they're going to introduce, which is one of the reasons why, although they have now got their licence back and that has all been agreed, it's probably going to be a couple more months before they actually reopen their doors. I mean, part of that is they've got to rebook stuff in because they cancelled everything. But also they have said all these new measures that we have committed to, we will make sure that all of that is in place before we open our doors for the first time. And it will take a little bit of time to fulfil all of those new commitments.
Yeah, because as well as ID scanning and getting in a new security company, they've also got to set up new search procedures, including new monitoring and external auditing of those procedures, more covert surveillance, lifetime bans for anyone found buying or selling drugs in the venue, improved lighting, more CCTV, and not allowing anyone under the age of 19 onto the premises Friday, Saturday and Sunday nights, which I guess, I mean...
I don't quite know what difference that one year makes. But
well, they want to stop 18-year-olds dying in the venue. I mean, the two people who died were both 18, so I guess they were like, well, if no 18-year-olds allowed in...
Don't really understand that, but... I mean, you know, let's hope in two ways that all of these new measures, A, allow Fabric to reopen and to stay open for the foreseeable future, because it would be a massive loss to sort of London's nighttime cultural scene if it was to disappear. And more importantly than all of that, that perhaps, you know, will these measures mean that this can be a completely safe environment and we won't have any of those horrible instances like we did have earlier this year, or indeed happen at other events and other clubs, you know, all around the UK and all around the world. So we will see. In terms of, you mentioned there's quite a lot of that money left.
Yeah, nearly £200,000 left.
And one of the things, which I know we talked about in the podcast before, that they have committed to spend at least some of that money on, indeed they already are, is in addition to fighting the specific licensing scenario that Fabric found itself in, there is a feeling that the guidelines that government publish around the Licensing Act that covers all of this are not good enough. And it's interesting when you talk to promoters, whether they're club promoters or festival promoters or whatever, so much of this happens at a local level. Although the Licensing Act is a bit of national law, so it starts with a piece of national law, actually how that legislation is then applied is very much in the hands of local police forces and local councils. And there is a perception that certain councils and certain police forces are much better than this. Obviously, we saw Arches in Glasgow close, and, yeah, and the police force there were criticised for the way that they handled that, where there are some certain other cities. I think Manchester has a good reputation as a council and a police force of working with the local clubbing community to grasp all of this. So it will be interesting to see how Fabric now lobbies government, how those guidelines get amended, how local councils and police forces then implement those updated guidelines, and whether any of the measures that are being introduced at Fabric might be proposed for other promoters around the country to implement.
Yeah, so I think that will probably take a sizable chunk of the remaining funds. But they have also said they will donate money to other worthy causes within the industry. So possibly kind of drug education programs or other venues fighting similar licensing issues. Who knows? I mean, they haven't really gone into detail on what that is yet. But I think there's further statements expected on that side of things.
And in the meantime, they're planning a piece of artwork in the venue that will somehow give credit to all the people that donated some money to the sort of the Save Fabric campaign.
Yeah, so if you did that, then you should keep an eye on your inbox. Apparently, something's going to happen.
Something's going to happen. But the thing that's definitely going to happen is at some time, we don't quite know when yet, but in the relatively near future, Fabric will reopen its doors once again.
Still to come, we'll be looking through a few of this week's other music business stories in brief. Plus, we'll be looking at a music video in audio form. but first, Amazon. Amazon, having gone into every other business in the entire world, is now going into ticketing. It's going to shake up the ticketing industry. And as we've discussed last week, it's ripe for shaking.
Yes. So now, those of you who've been paying attention might be saying, but Amazon are already in ticketing, because actually Amazon launched their first ticketing service here in the UK last year.
Yes, part of Amazon Local.
Yeah, which was a thing.
Which, who knows what that is?
But it's now called Amazon Tickets. I'm assuming at some point in the last year, without us noticing, either Amazon Local was shut down or Amazon Tickets was taken and set up as its own thing. I don't know. Anyway, what we do know is last year, Amazon started selling tickets initially for West End shows. Okay, so a little bit of theatre, a few musicals. So that's where they began. And then as 2015 went on, they started doing gigs. They're also doing comedy now. So if you Google Amazon Tickets and go to the UK site, you will see an assortment of shows that you can buy tickets from. So that's where they're at currently. But the news this week, and this is all based on some recruitment advertising that the website Recode spotted, is that Amazon are seemingly recruiting a bunch of new people, both in Europe and in the US, with a vision to expanding this sort of fledgling...
And Asia, I think.
...Amazon Tickets setup.
Yeah, and those adverts stated some aims of the expanded ticketing service. So we know a little bit about it. I mean, it quite boldly said they are aiming to become the world's premier destination for purchasing tickets, which, I mean, there are there are problems with that we'll come on to, but who knows. It also says, our vision goes beyond just selling tickets as we aim to disrupt the entire live entertainment experience, including what happens before, during and after the show. The ticketing business is ripe for innovation and improvement, as much of the industry has not fundamentally changed since the 1970s.
On one level, I know what they're trying to say there. On another level, these days, you nearly always buy your tickets online, and you were not doing that in the 1970s.
No.
I don't think telesales had really taken off in the 1970s. People were still going to, like, record shops and the ticketing counter or box offices actually at the venue and buying their tickets there. So that's not completely accurate.
How are they going to influence what happens before, during and after the show? I mean, before, like, I mean, deals to get your meal included with your ticket, that exists already. That's not a new innovation. After the show, well, they're going to, I don't know, maybe they'll order you an Uber to go home in. During the show, I mean, that's the show, isn't it? I don't want the people I bought tickets from to do anything during the show.
They'll have staff at the venue tapping you on your back saying, are you all right?
You're enjoying it?
Yeah.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah. I say, oh, look at that over there. That's what they're going to do.
It's a really good bit coming up.
Yeah, exactly that. I suppose there's been lots of talk over the years of the content side of the music industry and the live side of the music industry sort of integrating. And the most basic form of that is the sort of the ticket music bundle, which is sort of becoming irrelevant in the streaming age. But in the sort of the CD or download age, the idea that when you buy a ticket, you might also get the download album with it. Or when you buy the album, you might buy a ticket with it. It's an upsell bundling sort of thing. And one of the challenges there is that the music industry is so split into two. And you've got the labels and the publishers over here who deal in content, and the promoters and the agents over here who deal in live. And there's very little crossover. There are a handful of companies that dabble in both. But in the main, the record industry and the publishers and the promoters and the agents have very little to do with each other. So actually, once an artist has got their deals underway, obviously you've got a total DIY artist, they can very much integrate the content and the live experience. But once an artist is working with business partners, actually that's a lot harder to organise than it should be. That period when HMV, as a record seller, then bought into live and they bought up a load of venues and festivals, there was an element of, oh, perhaps HMV could be the company to properly integrate the content and the live experience, but then they didn't really do it. And then, of course, HMV fell over. And as part of that, the live bit of the business got sold off separately. But obviously, Amazon are very much on the content side, both traditionally by selling CDs and then downloads, and especially at the moment, now they're going full on into the streaming space. So perhaps there's something that they could do by integrating the content side of Amazon and the ticketing side of Amazon. So you get your ticket, and then they push content at you through that app or through the Echo device, and then something happens afterwards. Perhaps there's a live record. Perhaps that's where their sort of vision is going, that we should be with you every step of the way.
Perhaps. I mean, we mentioned issues. I mean, there have been a lot of startups in recent years who were going to shake up the ticketing industry. And the problem is that, certainly at the top end, the live industry is quite a closed shop. I mean, the biggest promoter, Live Nation, owns a lot of big venues, and also the biggest ticketing company, Ticketmaster.
Yes.
And that does put everyone else kind of on the outside, even Amazon with all Amazon's money. And I'm assuming Amazon doesn't really want to go into concert promotion and venue ownership.
It is interesting. And there was a period, slightly less now, but about 2 or 3 years ago, nearly every music tech startup that pitched to us as journalists, they weren't pitching to us for money, we haven't got any money, but we could give them coverage. And so all the tech startups, having
to justify yourself to me,
having previously been streaming services, and then all the startups realised that you needed like $1 billion to launch a streaming service. So they'll all be ticketing companies, because all of the legacy, heritage, classic ticketing platforms, they're all awful and horrible user experience, particularly on mobile. And then nobody likes the sort of the classic ticketing brands because they associate them with those booking fees that nobody understands and nobody likes. So a great opportunity here. And of course, on the B2B side, promoters, it all became about data. Everyone wants data. And the traditional ticketing companies used to be really bad at sharing data, at telling you exactly who you'd sold tickets to, what their email addresses were. And so you had all these startups saying, we've got a super duper user-friendly platform. We're completely mobile based. So if people want to buy tickets on a mobile, they can. In fact, the mobile phone is the ticket, which possibly overcomes some of the touting issues. I mean, often not really, but it can help. Plus, we'll give you all the data. We'll give you real-time data. And if people sort of scan in their phone as they walk into the venue, you can follow people. If you've got a multi-venue festival, you can follow people, get all that data too. Brilliant, brilliant. So stop working with Ticketmaster. Stop working with C-Ticket. Stop working with Aventim, one of the big brands elsewhere in Europe. Work with us. But as you say, there are various problems with that, Live Nation being one of them. The fact that the biggest promoter, second biggest venue owner, biggest artist management company in the world.
Of course, I missed that bit out.
is Ticketmaster. So immediately, that's a big chunk of the live and artist community that it's hard to crack. And even though you've got all of their competitors, obviously, after the Live Nation Ticketmaster merger, AEG were very keen to work with anybody who wasn't Ticketmaster. So there is an opportunity there. But while promoters like better data, and while promoters like having a better platform to sell their tickets through, there are two things that promoters, particularly at the upper end, once you're doing sort of big theatre level shows or arena tours, there are two things that those people really like from a ticketing company. Number one, they like ticketing companies with massive databases so that those ticketing companies can help with the marketing, help selling the tickets. And obviously, that's what a Ticketmaster and a C-Tickets and a Ventum, they've got those databases. They know who bought tickets to every show over the last, well, in some cases, because they started logging all that data when they moved over to telesales in the 90s, they've got, you know, 20 years worth of data that they can use to try and sell tickets to the right people. So promoters like that. They like the fact that these legacy ticketing companies have the database. The other thing that promoters like is money. And if you
love it.
We love money. If you're putting on a big arena tours are expensive and you need cash flow. And so what you really want from a ticketing company is for the ticketing company to say, all right, then we'll advance you cash on unsold tickets. So when you're putting on events, there's various things, which is if you put on an event and then the event gets cancelled, the credit card companies and the banks, who these days will have done most of the transactions, because that's generally these days how people buy their tickets in Europe, because it's a bit of European law, the credit cards and the banks have to refund the money if an event is cancelled. So what that means is that ticketing companies by default hang on to the money until the event has happened. So that if there is then a cancellation, the ticketing company still has all the money it took. It can hand it back to the credit card companies. You can hand it back to the consumers and everybody's happy. But if I'm a promoter, I need the money. I need the money to put on the event. I can't wait till the event is over. So I need you to advance the money. And so ticketing companies with promoters they trust will advance the money on sold tickets. But what you really want as a promoter is not just advanced on sold tickets. The best thing is advances on unsold tickets. So you haven't sold the tickets yet, but you think that you will. So give me £1 million now, then sell the tickets and get your money back. And so that's the sorts of things that promoters of bigger shows are looking for. And that always plays to the big legacy companies, to the Ticketmasters who have deep pockets, who have the cash flow, who can, for the right artist, say, all right, then, if you give us 90% of all the tickets, have £1 million. We'll take the risk. Because remember, if the show goes under, and you, Mr. Promoter, bankrupt yourself, we're then liable for that £1 million because we'll have to refund the tickets to the punters. But we'll do that deal to get the exclusive rights, and here's £1 million. And if you're a startup, even if you're a startup that does actually raise a few million, as some startups do, but you're not raising a few million in order to be advancing millions to promoters, you're doing that to build your infrastructure. So it's really hard. Grassroots level, everything's to play for. And at a grassroots level, having great data, a more user-friendly platform, that is appealing to grassroots venues and smaller shows. But once you get to those big shows, which is where the really good money is, then it's really hard to take those companies on. And it was Tesco, I think, dabbled with ticketing. And there's lots of things about the legacy ticketing platforms. I mean, they're right, that particularly the booking fees thing. The booking, everyone hates the booking fees.
And I think that's one of the features of Amazon tickets is there are no booking
fees.
Well,
there are booking fees, but you don't see them.
Yeah.
Exactly, you don't see them. So the booking fees, the price that is on the homepage includes the booking fee. You have to sort of dig if you want the breakdown. And there was an element of, well, why are the booking fees still there? Why isn't the experience more user-friendly? And I remember when Tesco dabbled, that was interesting. Could Tesco come in and shake this up? But I think Tesco quite quickly realised you'd have to spend a lot of money on this if you were going to take on the ticketing industry. And that wasn't really what Tesco wanted. It was sort of a periphery thing to them. So they didn't really go full on into it. Amazon, of course, do have a great database of music consumers because they've been selling CDs to people for all these years and then more recently download. So they have a phenomenal database of names, email addresses, addresses and credit card information, all linked to music data. So they do have the database. They can be pushing shows. Plus, if they need to, they've got quite a lot of money. Now, they possibly don't want to be writing multi-million dollar checks to artists and promoters, but they do have access to cash if they need to. So in some ways, Amazon could overcome some of the issues that a startup starting from scratch couldn't. But nevertheless, it is still a tricky market to get into. And beyond the Live Nation Ticketmaster thing, there are plenty of artists and promoters who have been working with C-Tickets or Eventim or, you know, or one of the smaller players for a long time. And there's a real loyalty there. So there'd have to be something really good about the Amazon service to make people... I mean, they might give them 10% of their tickets, but for Amazon to get big chunks of tickets for big shows, they might have to write some big checks to get that. And it would be interesting to see whether or not they would be willing to go that far to disrupt the ticketing market.
Yeah, so bold claims at the moment, but we will see how Amazon Tickets plays out.
And also how it does integrate. If it does, it may not, but will it integrate with the new streaming service? There's definitely talk about it somehow being within the Prime scheme. So it may well be that there's money off if you're a Prime member, or you get priority access if you're a Prime member. So I suppose that's good for Amazon. It makes Prime more attractive, possibly good for promoters. It's an extra way to market your shows. Who knows? But if they do start to grow the service, it will be interesting to see how it integrates with the other Amazon services. And sometimes Amazon are good at integrating stuff, and other times it's a really clunky experience, and you think surely Amazon should be able to do this better. So we'll see.
Let's have a quick look through some of this week's other big music business stories, starting with a CSAC report. That's CSAC, not CSAC. That Songwriters Society's collected €7.5 billion last year.
Yes, so the latest figures pack from CSAC, as I call it, to distinguish it from the American...
C-I-S-A-C. So this stands for...
Oh, it's something in French, isn't it?
Yes.
So it's the International Confederation of Something.
No, in French.
It's the organisation that brings together the songwriter societies all around the world. So PRS in the UK, Gamer in Germany, and all of those organisations. And they put out this report each year. Actually, there's also some collecting societies who are members of CSAC, which are not music. There's a few audiovisual or visual art societies. So that always confuses things. So actually, we said 7.5 billion. If you look at the figure on the front of that report, it says 8.6 billion, because 1.1 billion has nothing to do with music. But we don't care about that. We're not interested if it's not music.
Not bothered.
So we're only interested in the 7.5 billion. And it's an interesting report. It's the money that's flowing into the music publishers and to the songwriters. One thing that is interesting is how little of that money is coming from the digital domains. A relatively small slice of that money is coming from digital services. Most of it is coming from live and broadcast and stuff like that. Although it has to be said, because of the slightly complicated way that the music publishers license a Spotify, not all of the digital income flows through the collecting societies. Therefore, not all that money is represented in the CSAC figures. So it's not a complete picture on the digital front. Although this year, they have put an extra chapter in the report where they consider the wider digital environment and the monies that flow into the industry through other routes to try and provide a better overview of what's happening from a music publisher, songwriter perspective in digital, which predictably ends up in some coded YouTube bashing. So
yes.
If you're a fan of YouTube bashing, this is the latest thing to be reading.
Last week, we discussed how a lobbying organisation for the internet industry, if that is a thing,
The web giants, the Amazons, the Googles.
Yeah, they'd got in their demands for President Trump with a very long letter. The key thing we picked out was them saying, don't get rid of the safe harbours, we need those, they're good. After that, the music publishers got in their list of demands. We did suggest that they do it as a bullet-pointed list.
I said as a limerick.
Or as a limerick, I think we did. Yeah, we did boil it down to in the end. They did not do that, but no. I don't think it was as long a letter.
No, it was a slightly punchier letter. Although I suppose they've got a slightly narrower list of topics to cover. So it was the National Music Publishers Association, so the American music publishers trade body, got their letter in, also covering safe harbors and consent decrees. And I suppose what they were saying, as I think we probably predicted, was obviously one of Donald Trump's things is going to take on the big lobbying machine. And so they were saying, well, the big lobbying machine under the Obama administration has been the Googles of this world, who the Obama administration seemed to have been in awe of. So if you're going to take on the lobbying machine, those are the companies you should start ignoring. And while you're doing that, please be more friendly to songwriters and music publishers on things like safe harbors, reforming the consent decrees, etc., etc. The letter is on our website if you want to read it.
Yeah.
So maybe you'll link to it from the podcast.
Maybe I will.
Who knows?
Maybe we'll see. Sticking with song rights, as we will be for the foreseeable future, the US radio industry is suing Global Music Rights, accusing it of monopoly abuse. And Global Music Rights is Irving Azoff's collecting society, relatively small one, but with some big artists.
Yes. So obviously in the US, there are multiple collecting societies representing the performing rights in songs. So the equivalent of the PRS here in the UK. So there is ASCAP, there is BMI, there is the other CSAC, spelt with an S.
S-E-S-A-C.
Correct.
Stands for...
I don't really know. I think the E might be European. And the C is probably composers. And the A might be authors. And the S might be songwriters.
Which S?
The last S. Which would make the first S society. That would work, wouldn't it?
So we think it might be called...
The Society of European Composers, Authors and Songwriters. Or the A might be an and. Who
no,
knows?
No, that wouldn't work. You've got the letters the wrong
Have
way.
Have I got the letters the wrong way?
Anyway,
around.
Carry on.
So there are
He wasn't even French that time. Really let me down.
There are multiple collecting societies representing the performing rights in songs in the US. As we have discussed at length on the podcast, ASCAP and BMI, which are the big two, are regulated by these things called the consent decrees. CSAC isn't, although there have been some landmark court rulings, which mean they are sort of regulated, and certain of the rules that apply to BMI and ASCAP also apply to CSAC. Global Music Rights is very new, it's only a couple of years old, it's very small, so basically this is the radio industry wanting to go to court to try and get the same regulations they managed to get applied to CSAC applied to GMR, so we'll see whether or not that happens. They're saying they're, well, clearly Irving Azoff has been asking for lots of money from the radio companies.
Which is what he set it up to do.
And they're saying that's an exploitation of monopoly. I would argue that's a bit of a odd interpretation of the word monopoly, because there's an element of the reason why you regulate collecting societies when there is just one, like a PRS or a Gamer or a SACEM, is if you're a radio station, there's an element of, well, I either have to have a PRS license or I can't play any music. So therefore, it's like, that's a competition law issue. There needs to be some regulation. But Global Music Rights, although they represent some really big songwriters, they don't actually represent that many songwriters. So there's an element of, well, either you do the deal and you play Pharrell's tracks, or you don't, and you don't. So I don't really understand why that's a monopoly. But, hey, we'll see what happens when it goes to court. I suspect Irving might fight this through the courts rather than doing a sneaky settlement behind the scenes. But we'll see.
One more songwriter story. How about it? Boomer Stemra.
The Dutch.
Which stands for...
Presumably it does stand for something. Presumably it stands for something in Dutch.
Well, it's no excuse, is it? But anyway,
there's no N in there, so where would the Netherlands be? But who knows? So these Boomer Stemra is the Dutch version of, well, actually technically PRS/MCPS. The development with Boomer this week is that it has transpired of late that certain European collecting societies, including Boomer, have been offering concert promoters sneaky discounts on the licenses that they provide to concert promoters to cover the performing rights in the songs.
Up to 25%.
That the promoters stage performances of. And this has been an issue, particularly in the management community. Certain managers have found out about these discounts and said, well, we were never really told about these discounts. And so when we do a deal with a promoter, they'll say, oh, we've got a Boomer Stemmer license, so that 7% of ticket money goes on the royalties, which, because you're the songwriter as well as the performer, that's going to come back to you if you're a British songwriter, probably through PRS. But then it turned out, actually, they weren't paying 7%. They were paying less than 7%. So this was all a bit of a hoo-ha. And on the back of that, Boomer Stemmer have now said, all right, then, we're going to stop doing discounts, except for one. Yeah. No more discounts, oh, apart from a 5% discount. But that's going to be super transparent. So no more controversy on the Boomer Stemmer concert promoter discount, please.
Now, leaving songwriters, but sticking with live music, look at the journey we've taken. Tea in the Park's not happening next year.
No Tea in the Park next year. This was confirmed not long before we started recording the podcast, although rumours were already circulating, partly because DF Concerts, the Live Nation affiliated company that stages Tea in the Park, is in talks with Glasgow City Council to do another festival, different festival, on Glasgow Green, pretty much the same weekend that Tea in the Park would be happening. So that was a hint that probably there wasn't going to be a Tea
in
the Park.
Glasgow Council's state was very much, we are not talking about Tea in the Park and we have no interest in staging Tea in the Park. Tea in the Park is rubbish.
Well, I think that was Glasgow residents fearing that some campsite was going to be set up near their homes. And that's not what this new festival is going to be. Of course, Tea in the Park moved sites 2 years ago, has had quite a few problems at its new site, particularly on year number one, various licensing issues making the site work. So that is presumably one of the reasons why a very long-standing festival is going to take a year off in 2017. New festival launched in Glasgow. Who knows what will happen in 2018?
Yeah, and you can read all of these stories in full if you go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast, find the show notes for this show, and all the links will be in there.
They will be.
Mm. Okay, finally this week, OK Go! I've got a new music video out. And OK Go having a music video out is a thing.
It's news.
Because OK Go are known for their music videos.
They are known.
A lot more than they are for their music. Well,
I was a bit rude about OK Go on Twitter this morning. I had a conversation on Twitter. It's a long time since I've had a conversation with someone.
What was that like?
On Twitter. I felt quite nostalgic. Because
for the days before Twitter was awful.
Do you remember, whatever it was, 3 years ago, when we all used to banter on Twitter and have hilarious conversations that used to lighten the mood for many onlookers, I'm sure. And that doesn't happen.
That was longer than 3 years ago.
Whatever that was. So that doesn't happen anymore on Twitter. But Simon Pursehouse off of Centric Music was obviously had watched new OK Go video, which we're about to talk about. I mean, in some ways, for most of what we're about to talk about to make sense, you probably ought to pause the podcast and go and watch the video if you haven't already watched it.
No, I'm going to explain what happens. You don't need to watch it.
All right, then. Well, hold on. Hold that
thought. I mean, you should watch it. It's good.
Hold that thought.
So, but I'm worried that if people pause and go away, they might not come back.
They might not come back. Let's assume they've already seen it. Because as you say, a new OK Go video is an event. But Simon said it must be tiring being in OK Go because it's quite an energetic video. And I said something along the lines of, well, when you put so little effort into the songs, you've got all the energy left to go into the video. But my point sort of being is, everybody can remember various OK Go videos that have been put out in recent years, but I bet the average person couldn't hum you an OK Go song.
No. I mean, it's clichéd to say things like that. However,
it's a true.
I mean, clichés are clichés for a reason, aren't they?
Indeed. And, I mean, perhaps I need to watch it multiple times, but I can't say. I was impressed by the video. Again, it's another great video. I'm a sucker for slow motion, so it made for me, really. But I can't really remember much about the music, except there was a bit of piano at the start.
There was some music.
There was definitely some music in there.
Yes, there was, yes.
Anyway, Andy Malt, you said you were going to explain this video for people who haven't watched it because they're not allowed to go and watch it now because if they did, they might not come back to our podcast.
The video is 4.2 seconds long, initially. It starts off, it all happens very quickly. There are explosions. You see members of the band.
Very briefly. It's 4.2 seconds.
Just chaos. But it's 4.2 seconds and that's it, done. And then they show you it again, slowed down to 4 minutes.
Yes.
And it reveals itself. It turns out that actually all of the various explosions that seem to happen at once were very minutely timed. So when you slow it down, those are synced up to the music.
I thought the most impressive bit, because they have a whole load of guitars exploding, don't they?
Yes.
And they, and I mean, again, in real time, they basically all exploded at the same time. But it was quite clearly, I mean, it could only have been fractions of a second between each, because when the slowed down version, they all go off one after the other.
And there's band members like lip syncing to bits of the music and doing flick books of the singer,
which is pretty impressive. I mean, I'm not quite sure quite how precisely the flip books lip sync.
Oh, give them a break!
pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it works. I mean, better than you would imagine it would work based on what I've just described.
In real time, they must have really quickly flicked through those different images. So the fact that when slowed down, they do sort of lip sync.
And presumably just like move their mouths very quickly.
Yes, in order for it to look like they are lip syncing.
It's an impressive feat. I mean, I think more normally, you watch an OK Go video and you go, that was impressive. I like how they did that, but I can see how they did that. Whereas this one, I found myself this morning, like, sitting, pausing the sped up bit.
Oh, right, to try and see the bits.
Yeah, and there's like that.
I wonder how many practices they did, because presumably they must have done some practices.
Yeah, but that must have taken a long time to set up.
Well, there would have been a lot of cleaning up, because after those 42-point seconds, the warehouse they're using would be very messy and sticky and wet. So,
yes.
So I don't know, perhaps they did do it first time, but I can't believe that they did.
If you want to know how they did it, OK Go frontman Damien Kulash has said how he did it on the OK Go website, which is very handy, because I also, as well as pausing the thing, I was looking through YouTube comments, and that's not a good way of trying to find out how someone did, because there's lots of people going, this is fake, they didn't really do it, it's got bits of it like sped up and slowed down.
Well, that is true. So, that bit is
that is true.
The slowed down version, they focus in on certain bits,
but that's what actually is impressive about it. When you read the method, there are 318 digitally triggered events in that 4.2 seconds. And actually, he gives us a screenshot of like the spreadsheet he used to map out how everything would work, which in itself is just a phenomenal piece of work. And it's only a tiny bit that he screen grabbed. And so they use these digital triggers to precisely trigger things at the right time. They have the cameras are on robotic arms, so they can move fast enough to capture everything at the right speed. Also, there's no camera control system that could actually do what appears to happen in one movement in existence. So it's actually seven camera movements with cameras going at different speeds. So when they slow it all down, but the cameras were filming at different speeds to capture things correctly.
Yeah, because I suppose when they do slow it down, and particularly where you've got sort of the really good liquid, which is always great to sort of see that in really slow motion as it's sort of exploding and liquids flying over. But that is actually, you're right, incredibly high quality for what is a fraction of a second pulled out. So yeah, the tech that must have been involved in capturing all of those images must have been pretty damn good.
And you say exploding, there's also a lot of exploding salt. Salt is the key thing.
Is
because
it?
Because it is sponsored by a salt company.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that bit. So sorry, salt company. But well done for sponsoring something that exciting, but I didn't get that.
Yes. So as well as a 4.2 second segment, there's also an extra segment at the end, the last section of
it
the
is.
Song.
Because
still, the full music video shoot is less than 25 seconds.
Because the guitars exploding is the end of the 4.2 seconds.
Yes, and then there's another section.
There is.
There's a bit that's filmed
a lot
in
more
real
the,
time, I think.
There's a lot more of the band in the last 2 minutes than there is in the 4.2 point seconds, whatever it is, slowed down.
Well, you mentioned the guitars. There were people on YouTube, as I said, I was reading the comments. Never read the comments. There were a lot of people complaining about needlessly destroying guitars. Turned out the band had thought of that too. They were Fender guitars that were going to be destroyed anyway because they hadn't met quality standards. So you can stop moaning about that. And
I think in the wider scheme of things, what's happening in the world at the moment, a few guitars being trashed, it's not something to be losing sleep over.
And in fact, more...
But what about all that salt? That's the bigger issue. I could have had that on my chips.
Well, you could have done, but it was all colour. I don't think it would be safe to eat.
Was anybody writing about that in the YouTube comments? I'm going to go...
No, but they were. They're all,
I'm going to go to YouTube later.
There were a lot of people saying, you did all this for salt. it turns out Morton Salt, the company that sponsored it, apparently did come to them and say, would you like to do something with salt? What a pitch.
I need to go back and watch this video and look out for the salt now.
But they've also set up a campaign called Walk With Her, which is funding and supporting people who make a positive difference in the world. So all you naysayers, this is all for a good cause. apparently.
Make the world better with salt?
I guess.
Is salt have to be involved in making the world a better place? I mean, we're heading into the winter now, and salt's very important in the winter months, isn't it? To keep the old roads from not being dangerous, from everyone sliding all over
the place.
Okay,
go. I've used it all now, so there's no more salt.
All the salt is gone. I come from Cheshire. That's home of salt. So I always have a ready supply of salt. So if they want to do a sequel...
Home of salt.
There's a lot of salt mines in Cheshire. So,
is that an official tourist tagline?
Hey, there is a salt museum. don't you knock it.
A salt museum? I mean,
a museum about salt.
Not a museum about assaults.
Yes, correct.
You don't want to get those mixed up.
Different things. But if they wanted to do a sequel, they should come to Cheshire because there's a lot of salt underground.
Oh, well, I'll get on the phone to OK Go later.
And tell them.
Yeah, come to Cheshire.
Come to Northwich.
There's
Nantwich.
Loads of salt there.
Or Middlewich.
I'm not sure obtaining salt was the biggest problem in this video.
Given their sponsor. But most of their videos since, because there was a big thing about how OK Go, I think they were signed to EMI, I think they got dropped, and then sort of they then became this video phenomenon. And obviously, most of the videos they've done. I mean, the treadmill one. And obviously, although a lot of work went into that, it wasn't necessarily that expensive to produce. They just had to buy 4 treadmills and run on them.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the subsequent ones clearly have been quite expensive. And I think most of them have had a sponsor. So it's interesting, a band who has started working with... And some very unusual brands. It's very rare that they work with like a Coke or somebody like that. It is normally, I think one was an insurance company that you'd never heard of or something, or pension company or something. So they do work with some weird brands to create these videos. But you were saying that some of the people in the comments were talking about what an OK Go... I mean, clearly they've got a fan base. They're a jobbing band.
I think, but the thing that comes up is exactly what you said at the beginning, is that like, wow, they make good videos, but who can remember any of their songs? Why don't they just make videos? But then I think what some people were saying is that, I mean, you kind of forget they're a working band, and they put a lot of effort into their shows as well. I think they're not exploding salt in their shows.
Well, they should be.
But maybe they will now.
Given they've got a ready supply of salt. So yeah, if you've not seen it, go and check out that video, the initial 4.2 seconds, and then everything that follows.
Yeah, when we watch the whole, don't just watch the 4.2 seconds.
Well, that's what you told me to do. And when I said, are we going to talk about that video, does that mean I have to watch it? You said, oh yeah, you have to watch the first point for 2 seconds.
I'm sorry you didn't have time.
I am very busy, but I did watch the rest of the video as prep and research for this podcast.
So yeah.
Even though I didn't notice any of the salt.
Well, I don't think you would know it was salt unless someone told you.
Which, and you did.
I did.
Well done.
Anyway, so that's your thing to go and listen to / watch now.
More
we've
watch
got to
than
the end
to, I imagine.
Of the podcast. You can listen to, I mean, you need to listen to it because it's all synced to the music. You'd lose something in having it on mute.
There's only one OK Go song I can sort of vaguely remember because I think I had it in my MP3 collection in the days when you had such a thing. But that was predated all of the clever video stuff.
Yeah, I guess that's another thing people forget, is that they were around for a long time before they... I mean, not before they ever made videos, but before they were known for making videos. And they weren't really any good then.
But well done, OK Go.
But do go and watch their new video.
And thank you for making it all about slow motion stuff because I like that.
Yes, as well as going and watching that new video, your homework for this week is to write, listen to the CMU podcast on a piece of paper and then slip it into a stranger's pocket. Maybe put the URL on there as well. Maybe not. Just maybe leave an air of mystery. Air of mystery, I guess.
I bet if you Google CMU podcast, we probably come pretty high up the list. I would imagine. Do Carnegie Mellon University have a podcast?
No, but there's some other Christian university, I think.
That does have a podcast. Yeah. Okay, so they might end up listening to that. So,
well, that's the risky take, isn't it?
And that's your Sunday morning podcast, not your Saturday night podcast.
The bracket's the Saturday night one.
Yeah. Make sure that's
really
clear.
That'll make it clear.
Yeah, the one with Vernon Kay.
In the new year. Let's... not rush into things. Anyway, this podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook for now. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
The Saturdays shaking around.